This is an important book. They're selling it downstairs at the Coop. You should go buy it. Let me take 1 minute to 90 seconds. As I said, Brett is a professor at Cardozo Law School. He directs the IP program there. He's done a lot of work on a lot of interesting things, but let me just talk about why I think this book is important. It essentially sits at the center of two major questions. One is, what is the role of the public in the context of an understanding of a declining role for the public, a growing role for the market, etc.? What is the role of public goods and the public? That's the infrastructure part. And in the commons part, which is generally closer to the hearts of people here at Berkman, Eleanor Ostrom's work has made a particular version of the commons extremely important, and that's governance of resources among closed groups that share ownership. But what's been, I think, grating in the relationship between the kinds of commons we've been working on in the digital environment and the kinds of commons that people working in that tradition have gone has been the fact that we're really talking about access to copyright. We're talking about non-discriminatory access to IP. It's a very different kind of commons, and it's also different from the kind of commons that people who worry about environmentalism and sustainable growth is. And what this book does is it's the most comprehensive, detailed economic analysis of this mode of the commons that started out with Carol Rose's work in the mid-'80s, moved on to the work that's so near and dear to our hearts here at Berkman, and that Brett has really done a fantastic job of trying to dig through the details of understanding it as an economic phenomenon. I think we're very lucky to be able to have him present to us. I look forward very much to hearing you.
Oh, thank you. All right. It's really an honor for me to be here with all of you today. I have to say I owe a deep debt of gratitude to plenty of people at the Berkman Center, including Yochai and Jonathan Zittrain and Larry Lessig and Susan Crawford, so I rely heavily on all of their work in this book and in other things that I'm working on. And just in more generally speaking, I rely on their support, and I have for the past decade. So it's especially exciting for me to be here today to sort of talk about this book with you. As you probably know, infrastructure is at the center of many contentious public policy debates, ranging from what to do about our crumbling roads and bridges, to whether and how to protect the natural environment, to patent law reform, to spectrum allocation, to energy policy, to network neutrality regulation and the future of the internet. Frankly, the list could go on and on and on. Although the policy arenas may seem unrelated, all of them are to some extent the same. Each of the policy debates involves a battle to control infrastructure, to set the terms and conditions upon which the public gets access, and, critically, to determine how infrastructure-dependent systems evolve over time. The battle is joined in each of these different areas, with some groups arguing for recourse to private property and market-based solutions, and other groups arguing that such an approach would be fatal. These two different sets of groups draw heavily on a broader intellectual debate that takes place in a number of different fields, certainly within law, within economics, within political science, and increasingly within engineering. On the private control side of that debate, there's a robust economic theory in support of private ordering with minimal government involvement. By contrast, on the open access side, there's a frequent call for protecting the commons. But the theoretical support for this call is underdeveloped from an economics perspective. So in this book, I fill that gap, or at least I try to, by advancing strong economic arguments for managing and sustaining infrastructure resources as commons. So here's the table of contents for the book. Gives you a sense of what I'm going to do. I'm not going to talk about all of this today. The first three parts of the book develop a general theoretical framework for examining the social value of shared infrastructure. Now, the framework is not tailored to any particular type of infrastructure. Instead, it's based on functional economic analysis of the characteristics of the resources. The final three parts of the book apply the framework to many different types of infrastructure, exploring nuanced trade-offs that arise in particular contexts, as well as common issues that actually cut across those different contexts. So here's what I plan to do today. I'd like to briefly provide some background on why I'm bringing together infrastructure and commons, two concepts that ordinarily don't get talked about together. Then I want to focus on what's the heart of the book, which is chapters 4 and 5. That's where I developed the framework for identifying infrastructural resources and evaluating the case for commons management. And then finally, I want to turn to the net neutrality debate, make a few potentially controversial arguments, although maybe less controversial to this audience, and then I'm going to suggest a rather strong network neutrality rule. Okay, so first, a little background. So when I say infrastructure, most people think of large-scale physical resource made by humans for public consumption. Things like highways, telephone networks, or public utilities. And I want to consider three generalizations about traditional infrastructure, part of what motivated me to write this book. First, the government has played and continues to play a significant and widely accepted role in ensuring the provision of many traditional infrastructure. Now, its role certainly varies based on the infrastructure we're talking about, the community that we're talking about, and so on. But the government's role as provider, subsidizer, coordinator, and/or regulator of traditional infrastructure provision remains intact in most communities throughout the world. The reason why is that left alone, infrastructure markets fail. And they fail in many different ways. There's lots of different types of market failures to consider. Okay, second general observation. Traditional infrastructure, generally speaking, are managed as commons. In short, the resource is accessible to all within a community, regardless of who you are or what you're planning to do. Now, for most public infrastructure, the relevant community is the public at large, as opposed to some more specific or narrowly defined community. Now, access to and use of most infrastructure are not prioritized based on who you are or what you're planning to do, except for in very special cases, right? Like the narrowly defined priority that we give to a police officer driving with their siren blaring and their lights on. Generally speaking, except in Moscow, right? That priority is not for sale. Right? You can't buy that kind of, you can't put a siren on top of your car. You can't buy that kind of priority for most infrastructure. Okay? Third basic observation. Traditional infrastructure generates significant spillovers that result in large social gains. Most economists recognize that infrastructure are important to society precisely because they give rise to large social gains. Now, the nature of those gains as spillovers may help explain why we, as a society, as individuals, as consumers, and as voters, take infrastructure for granted over and over and over again, right? The externalities are sufficiently difficult to observe or measure quantitatively, much less capture in economic transactions, and the benefits may be diffuse and sufficiently small in magnitude to escape the attention of individual beneficiaries, right? You or I might not appreciate when we're benefiting from someone else's use of the infrastructure. So one of the central objectives of the book is to explore the relationships between these three generalizations. Okay? Basically thinking about this interface between infrastructure and the various user activities that infrastructure support. Now, I'll come back to this so you don't have to dwell on this figure for too long. Now, at times, people have become confused about my thesis, believing it to be summed up with a catchphrase. If infrastructure, then commons. That's what Frischman says. I want to be very clear. That's not my thesis. It's the structure of the argument. Right? Chapter 4 focuses on infrastructural resources as a special type of resource. We're going to define a set. And Chapter 5 focuses on commons management as a type of resource management strategy. Okay? So let's turn to what constitutes infrastructure within the meaning of the book. So infrastructural resources satisfy these three criteria, which I'll talk about in turn. But I want to be clear at the outset, right? The criteria work together to delineate a set of resources that are functionally infrastructural. Some things you might think of as infrastructure, like an oil reserve, are not within the bounds of this theory, right? They're outside. And some things that you might think of as clearly not infrastructure, like the atmosphere or ideas, actually fall within the scope of this theory. It's important to point that out at the outset. So, the first criterion. Infrastructure are either pure or impure public goods. Okay? Non-rivalry over some appreciable range of demand opens the door to widespread shared access and productive use of the resource. In short, the first criterion describes the shareable nature of the resource, right? Sharing is technologically feasible. Those of you who've read some of Professor Benkler's work are probably seeing a connection, right? Now, this presents an important, though often overlooked and unappreciated, opportunity for society. Non-rivalry can be leveraged for a variety of purposes, right? The second and third criteria, right? Oh. The second and third criteria focus on the manner in which infrastructure generate value and a sense on how non-rivalry can be leveraged. These criteria are what move us beyond the basic public good classification, right? We're talking about a special type of public good or impure public good, and this is what raises additional demand-side implications. Societal demand for infrastructure is derived demand. Whether we're talking about a transportation system, the electricity grid, ideas, environmental ecosystems, or the internet infrastructure, the bulk of the social benefits generated by the resources derive from their downstream uses. Okay? Infrastructure are generic or general purpose resources, right? They're general purpose inputs, and the range of outputs can span private, public, and social goods. Okay? They're not special purpose resources, right? They're not optimized for a particular user or use to satisfy demand derived from a particular downstream market, right? So an electricity grid, for example, delivers power to the public, supporting an incredibly wide variety of uses, users, markets, and technologies. It's not specially designed or optimized for any particular use, user, market, technology, or appliance, right? It provides non-discriminatory service for a toaster and a computer, for staples and a pizzeria. The same could be said of the national highway system or the internet, right? These resources provide basic functionalities and both support and structure more complex systems of human activity, but they don't determine them, right? Users determine what to do with the capabilities that infrastructure provide. Genericness implies a range of capabilities, options, opportunities, or even freedoms. Users decide which roads to travel, where to go, what to do, who to visit. Users choose their activities. They can choose to experiment or innovate. They decide whether and what to build, right? They can decide how to use their time and other complementary resources. To understand societal demand and how value is actually created in the real world, we need to pay closer attention to the user activities and what it is that users produce. So the third criterion emphasizes the production of public and social goods. When infrastructure support these kinds of activities, there are good reasons to question how well markets will work in assessing demand and supplying infrastructure resources. In a sense, a gap between private and social demand arises. Now, the reason for the gap is relatively straightforward. Infrastructure users' willingness to pay reflects their private demand. Right? This is the blue line. That's the value they expect to realize. It doesn't take into account the value that others might realize as a result of their use. It doesn't account for external effects associated with the production of public and social goods. Difficulties in measuring and appropriating value in output markets translates into a problem for infrastructure suppliers and consequently for the public. Right? This demand manifestation problem can affect infrastructure allocation, design, investment, and management. Society may want, need, or depend upon infrastructure use to a substantial degree more than private demand would suggest. And this raises two different sets of related social or market failure concerns. First are concerns about undersupply of the infrastructure and underuse of the infrastructure to produce public and social goods. And second are concerns about dynamic shifts in the nature of the infrastructure over time. Now, we can understand these concerns by comparing the private and social demand curves. Now, the private demand curve, again, this blue line, right, reflects users' willingness to pay. It effectively ranks individual uses according to private value from left to right, right? Sort of basic econ 101, right? Another basic econ, every single textbook will have something like this. Every single textbook will have something like the social demand curve to explain externalities, right? So the social demand curve is simply a demand curve shifted up from the private demand curve to reflect the aggregate spillovers that comprise the difference between social and private value. Now, there's a temptation to draw the curves as I have. Every single economic casebook does. This is how it's taught in every economic class, right? In other words, where the social demand curve has the same shape as the private demand curve. Doing so assumes each user generates an identical spillover, at least in magnitude. In the book, I suggest that this is entirely inappropriate. It might be the case that willingness to pay and the magnitude of an externality are correlated in some contexts, but there's absolutely no reason a priori to assume such a correlation, and making such an assumption can be misleading and distort your analysis. Frankly, the shape of the social demand curve can diverge substantially from that of the private demand curve, because there's no necessary or obvious relationship between private and social value of different users' use of the infrastructure. So we can take this drawing one step further and construct demand curves based on infrastructure uses or activities or markets based on aggregated demand for each different type of use. And this allows us to focus on variance among different uses. Okay? So basically, you create the step function where each one of these uses is just aggregating demand among the users and saying, well, how much is this activity worth in terms of what people are willing to pay? And then it's activity by activity just ranked according to the aggregate value as far as we would think, as the market would suggest. Okay? Now, with infrastructure that, I should throw up the next curve. So you might similarly suggest that classic economics would suggest that the social demand curve would probably look something like this, same kind of function, right? When infrastructure can be used to produce a wide variety of public or social goods, it's hard to know what the social demand curve will look like. But it's likely quite different from that of the private demand curve. It might look like this. Use type 6. People aren't willing to pay very much, but it generates a tremendous amount of social value, right? But of course, it also could look like that, where the third type generates more, but also so does type 6. Frankly, we don't know what the social demand curve looks like, and frankly, it may be unknowable in many circumstances, okay? And I want to consider two ways in which why do these divergences arise? So let's consider two ways in which the difference between private and social value, you know, why is there these big differences? Where do they come from? On one end of a continuum, right, the amount by which social value exceeds the private value could be driven by the magnitude of the external effect generated by a particular user-generated good, a public good or social good. Right? So in other words, there might be some infrastructure-enabled activity that generates substantial spillovers by virtue of the nature of some particular public or social good that someone creates. Think of the killer app. It can be very difficult, if not impossible, to predict where that's going to come from. At the other end of the continuum, at the other extreme, right, social surplus could derive from a large number of outputs that generate spillovers on a much smaller scale. Right? In which case, it's not the magnitude of the effect from a particular good that drives the analysis, but rather it's the number of users participating in the activity. Small-scale externalities can add up to a significant social surplus. We tend to overlook this other end of the continuum. Now, I'm going to try to illustrate this rather abstract idea with some examples, with an example. I use YouTube videos. YouTube's a pretty good example of this. There are tons of others, but we'll stick with YouTube. Right? So it gives a good illustration of both what I'll call the small scale and the killer app phenomena. Right? So many videos on YouTube are intended for a small audience, but reach a slightly larger audience. For example, suppose I post a video of my kids singing and dancing. I might send a link to my 25 friends and family, right? Expecting it to be viewed by 25 people. Perhaps 100 people actually visit, watch, and enjoy the whole video, right? This would generate small-scale spillovers to 75 extra people. I don't know exactly what the magnitude is, but I know that there's some positive value. Now, YouTube might capture some of the benefits, but the benefits are irrelevant to my own decision to post the video, this public good I've created and shared. Now, the benefits are incidental to me, and they might seem like small potatoes to you, but they add up considerably when you consider the basic fact that millions of people engage in this activity on a regular basis. Right? Millions of people creating small potatoes is a lot of potatoes. Right? Now, at the other end, every once in a while, there's a user-generated video that attracts millions and millions of viewers. Right? It's a cultural phenomenon. Now, in the book, I use a somewhat dated example from 2007, but you probably all know it, the Charlie Bit My Finger Again video. How many of you have seen that video? All right, almost everybody here. That video was intended for just one person, right? The boy's godfather who lived in the United States. Unexpectedly, it went viral. Hundreds of millions of people have viewed the video. And they've liked it and disliked it, and they have comments. They're engaging in a commentary about the video, right? That video generated enormous spillovers, social value above and beyond what the poster possibly could have anticipated or is capable of appropriating. Right? So small-scale spillovers add up when an activity is widespread. Those little videos actually do create social value. And you have substantial spillovers from a single video. Critically, neither the government nor the market would have selected that video ex ante and supported the producer. Right? The bottom line being that open video sharing platform provides users with a basic capability. It keeps social options open. When users choose to exercise that capability, they presumably do so because it satisfies their own self-interest, and at the same time, they incidentally generate spillovers for the rest of us because they've shared a public good. Now, I've described two extremes. There's a middle ground as well. I'm just trying to highlight the extremes so you can see different ways that social value is created through externalities. Right? And I should also note that YouTube is just one of many, many, many examples in the internet. Read Professor Benkler's book and you'll see a bunch more. But it's not just on the internet. These kinds of open platforms that give users capabilities to be productive we see them more regularly in society. Okay, now economists have long recognized that there's a case for subsidizing public goods producers because the market undersupplies such goods. But that often fails for a variety of reasons. Government has to assess demand. They've got to figure out which public and social goods are worth supporting. In many cases, it might be better to focus on infrastructure as an indirect means for supporting public and social goods producers. Okay, so there are also a second set of concerns having to do with how private infrastructure owners will manage the evolution of infrastructure over time. To the extent that infrastructure can be optimized or prioritized by design or access decisions in terms of pricing, which is frankly often the case, there's a risk that infrastructure suppliers will favor applications that generate more readily appropriable benefits. Right? This bias towards infrastructure uses that generate appropriable value is a direct, predictable, and quite natural consequence of the ordinary operation of the market system. So don't get me wrong. I want to be clear. This is a feature, not a bug, of the market system. We expect and encourage firms and entrepreneurs and other market participants to behave in this fashion. When feasible, firms manage infrastructure evolution. For example, through prioritization of investments, design choices, access to various communities. And they're going to do so to maximize expected value to the firm, not to society. Right? Whether or not this gives rise to a societal problem is a slightly different question, okay, that this book tackles to some degree. Okay, so thus far what I've tried to do is give you a sense of... actually, I think I've got another slide. Yeah, something that's not in my notes. So why does this matter? Why does this divergence between social value and private value, not only the divergence, but the fact that we don't know what the curve looks like, we don't know, it's uncertain, maybe unknowable, which uses or which users will generate social value in the future? Well, in the book, I talk about this to some degree in terms of option theory. But the basic idea is you're worried that infrastructure that can do this evolves to do this, right? The infrastructure providers are going to either we're going to see it evolve towards a special purpose input, right, for which there's the most readily appropriable returns, or perhaps just towards commercial infrastructure where there's a set of downstream activities that look attractive to the infrastructure owner, but not leading to the value, the public and social goods that society might wish to receive. Okay, so now I've given you a snapshot of Chapter 4 and the various ways of analyzing infrastructure in different demand-side market failures. What I want to very briefly do now is explain the role of commons management, which for purposes of this book is a little different than commons in the Ostrom sense. And so another work where I work in the Ostrom world, it's a bit different. But in the context of this book, when I say commons management, I'm generally referring to no discrimination based on the identity of the user or the use. Right, so everybody gets sort of equal symmetric access in terms of their use of the resource. Okay, so here's the idea. Managing infrastructure as a commons can be a more effective, albeit blunt, means for supporting the production of public and social goods and targeted subsidies. In fact, the bluntness of the means is part of the strength of it, right? Because it's not clear that governments can be very good at selecting the winners in terms of who to subsidize. Although it's not a direct subsidy, it effectively creates cross-subsidies, and it eliminates the need to rely on either the market or the government to pick winners among downstream uses. It also has dynamic implications apart from cross-subsidies. So it maintains flexibility and the generic nature of the infrastructure, and thus addresses persistent and systematic uncertainty about which uses or users will generate social value in the future. So in the book, I sort of explain this in terms of option theory, extending option theory to deal with uncertainty about social value, not just uncertainty about market value. And I'm happy to sort of talk about that in Q&A if people are interested. So now I want to move to the examples, to the net neutrality example. But before I make that jump, I want to make very clear that there are complications and there are counterarguments. This is why it's not just if infrastructure, then commons. It's complicated. Chapters 6, 7, and 8 of the book carefully analyze the potential impact of commons management or non-discrimination rules on infrastructure pricing, on supply-side incentives to invest, and on congestion management. And I say the potential impact because you shouldn't always believe the arguments that if you have a non-discrimination rule, it necessarily disrupts and destroys incentives. Not true. Same thing with respect to congestion management. It's important to keep that in mind. All right, so let me turn to leave those issues aside and turn to the neutrality debate. Here's the basic outline of the chapter. Again, for time, I want to get to Q&A, and I probably need to get to Q&A. I'm looking at the clock over there. I need to get to Q&A pretty soon. So I'll keep this brief. Much of the chapter focuses on this question. In just a few decades, right, the Internet's grown to become an integral part of our society, of our economy, of our daily lives. It's transformed and continues to transform various information and communications dependent systems, right? Our economic, cultural, political, scientific systems, right? Consider how the Internet provides and shapes opportunities for individuals, firms, households, governments, and other organizations to interact with each other and to participate in various social systems. Right? The scale and scope of possible and actual interactions alone is staggering. Now, it's easy to take such routine benefits for granted, as is commonplace for infrastructure. But I don't think I need to convince this audience that we shouldn't. So in the book, again, I focus quite a bit on this question. At the Berkman Center, I'm going to assume you all think that the internet's valuable to society, and I'm going to sort of push past this. I'm also going to push past a more detailed discussion of the different layered models of the internet and the particular layered model that I talk about in the book. I want to thank Susan Crawford for some of her earlier work that encouraged me to think very carefully about that top layer, the idea that there's a social layer that's important. But I'm going to skip past this discussion as well, which I think you guys are probably more or less familiar with. The basic idea is, in the book, I'm thinking about the infrastructural inputs to applications, content, and social relations as outputs, in terms of how it connects with other parts of the book. Okay, let me jump a bit to the net neutrality debate. And I'm not going to, and this is where I'm going to focus a bit of my the remaining time. The debate is alive. It's contentious in multiple fora. Right? It's been around for a decade. My prediction is it'll be around for another decade. At the heart of the debate is whether the internet infrastructure will continue to be managed as a commons. Okay? The basic policy issue to be resolved is whether the government should prohibit or regulate discrimination or prioritization by networks. And in the book, I suggest a rather stringent rule, more stringent than the FCC's rule, although they overlap quite a bit. And it's that the government should prohibit discrimination based on the identity of the user or the use, in other words, the sender or receiver of packets or the application or content for which the packets are inputs or will be resolved into. And I'll get into that rule in just a second. First, I want to briefly highlight a few ways in which the conventional economic analysis has completely distorted the debate. Okay, on both sides, by the way. So antitrust and regulatory economics suggest government interventions only needed when markets are not competitive, and that even when they are not competitive, interventions only justified in very narrow circumstances where demonstrable harm to consumers can be shown in the relevant markets and not outweighed by efficiency gains. It's a high burden. I believe the focus on competition and demonstrable harm to consumers is completely misguided. It distorts the debate dramatically and distracts participants from the more important fundamental question, which is, what type of internet environment our society demands? So I want to highlight three ways in which the debate's distorted. The first is that the conventional sort of antitrust and regulatory economic framework views the internet as a mere supply chain, just a string of markets supplying one thing to the next until you reach an end consumer. Slightly more sophisticated versions of the supply chain view incorporate so-called two-market theory, where economists put networks in between application and content providers on one side and consumers on the other, and then they consider how networks will be able to efficiently mediate transactions. One way or another, an incredibly complex open system is reduced to an inappropriately simple closed system for purposes of analysis, evaluation, and policymaking. These views assume away the incomplete and missing markets associated with public and social goods, despite their prevalence in the actual internet environment that we experience every single day. The internet's simply not a supply chain. Second, the antitrust and regulatory framework leads to misconceptions of the actors involved. You see this on both sides of the debate, by the way. Proponents of net neutrality make the same mistake, right? It creates this false distinction between application and content providers and other end users. I would argue that users produce a wide range of private, public, and social goods, including various applications and content. Google is just an end user, like you, me, or anyone else in the room. We're different in some ways, for sure, at least right now. For example, in the amount of traffic or revenue that we currently generate, but not necessarily in a way that matters to the fundamental question in the net neutrality debate. I, you, or anyone else could be the next Google. I could generate a whole lot of traffic tomorrow. I could be that new entrepreneur, like looking to generate the next big business. Finally, I think the debate's fixated on what I call the competition red herring. To cut to the chase, and again, this is something that you see on both sides of the debate, even if we assume we have robust competition in infrastructure markets, which we don't, it's a heroic assumption, it's not true, Susan can explain to you why it's not true. But even if we assume that, which is a fun assumption to make, the case for net neutrality remains strong. Competition alone does not alleviate the demand side concerns. Competition does not assure us of efficient allocation of resources. Competition does not assure us of an internet environment that maximizes social welfare. Competition does not address these interests for essentially the same reasons that antitrust law is orthogonal to environmental law. Antitrust law does not address market failures associated with externalities, whether we're talking about environmental pollution, negative externalities, or we're talking about the production, sharing, and productive reuse of public and social goods involving positive externalities. Right? Most economists recognize that competitive markets don't solve that problem, either one. All right, as I've discussed, conventional economic solutions to the underproduction of public and social goods don't work very well either in this context because of the incredible variety of producers and the incredible variety of public and social goods. The net neutrality debate is and must be complicated. It can't be reduced to a competition policy framework. Well, it shouldn't be. It can, it is, but it shouldn't be. It needs to grapple with the demand side issues. The internet enables the production of a wide variety of private, public, and social goods. Now, the supply chain view of the internet captures the commercial nature. And without a doubt, the value of the internet as commercial infrastructure is immense. We should support it. We care about that. It's really important. But the value of the internet as a public and social infrastructure dwarfs its value as commercial infrastructure. Now, I recognize it's incredibly difficult to substantiate this claim with empirical data that purports to measure value. But I think that's a problem with the ways we measure value. Right? Those are our measurement tools. Consider what makes the internet valuable to society. Again, its value to society is tied to the range of capabilities it provides to individuals, firms, households, governments, and so on to interact with each other and be productive. Commerce, community, culture, education, government, health, politics, science, and go on and on, are all information and communications intensive systems that the internet's transforming, and the transformations taking place at the ends where people are empowered to participate. And in the book, I provide an extensive discussion of these activities and the wide range of public and social goods. And I go further and I argue that the demand side case for managing the infrastructure as a commons is quite strong. So I argue in favor of, checking the time, of, oh, I thought that was up. Oh, so I'm a slide behind. My bad. I argue in favor of this rule. Okay? It's a strong rule, right? We should prohibit discrimination based on the identity of the user, use, and the handling of packets. Relatively simple formulation of a rule, it might seem overly strong in that it appears to rule out a significant range of activities some might label as reasonable network management. I think it depends on what you think that label applies to. The rule primarily precludes certain fine-grained forms of price discrimination, quality discrimination, and prioritization. It doesn't prohibit more efficient methods for dealing with congestion, like usage-sensitive pricing and congestion pricing. Now, of course, there can be problems with both of those types of pricing, but in general, they wouldn't be prohibited by the rule that I propose. The proposed rule effectively functions as a social option, which I think makes economic sense because of the persistent and systematic uncertainty about the future sources of both market and social value. Now, disabling identity-based price discrimination is not necessarily costless, but you shouldn't assume it to be costly either. The two principal advantages of price discrimination or quality discrimination or prioritization are increased output and thus reducing deadweight losses or increased profits to infrastructure providers that might lead to improved incentives to invest. Frankly, neither of these potential advantages appears to be nearly as significant as claimed in the debate. Lots of claims in the comments to the FCC. Very little theoretical modeling or evidence to support those claims. In addition, we sometimes hear arguments that identity-based discrimination or prioritization is an efficient way to manage traffic on networks for two different reasons, either to manage congestion or, on the other hand, to manage unlawful, hazardous, or harmful traffic. So far, at least, as far as I can tell, neither of these arguments is terribly convincing either. There are plenty of effective means for dealing with congestion that don't involve discrimination or prioritization. And perversely, permitting discrimination or prioritization may encourage infrastructure owners to maintain a persistent state of congestion. To my knowledge, and I frankly could be convinced otherwise, and this might be the audience that will convince me, managing unlawful, hazardous, or otherwise harmful traffic often can be handled at the ends without discrimination by infrastructure providers. Now, I understand that in special circumstances, it might be the case that narrowly crafted exceptions would make more sense, would make sense. But I think they should be narrowly crafted exceptions instead of tolerating broad reasonableness exceptions. Now, infrastructure analysis throughout the book, with its focus on demand-side issues and the function of commons management in terms of maintaining the option value of infrastructure, I think reframes the debate somewhat, right? It adds a weight on the scale, right? So you might describe the net neutrality debate very crudely. This is a very bad graphic, but crudely like this, right? I think that at least we got to entertain the possibility that it ought to look more like this, right? That there's a plenty of social value that we just don't have within the frame of analysis because it's hard to measure, but that maybe it ought to be taken into account. The analysis points towards a particular rule, and at a minimum, it encourages a comparative analysis of different solutions to congestion and supply-side problems. We actually have to analyze it and not just take companies at their word as to what they need to have. Now, I do acknowledge there are competing considerations. There's interest to balance. I'd leave question marks up there because I don't know for sure that it tilts that way. And I acknowledge that measuring the weight on the scale is difficult, if not impossible. That's kind of the point. Nonetheless, I maintain that it's substantial. The social value attributable to a mixed infrastructure is immense, even if immeasurable. In my view, the basic capability that the internet provides, the public and social goods produced by users on a regular basis, the transformations occurring on and offline as a result of the internet are all indicative of such value. Thanks.
Transferring this around. Let me throw a first question and then we'll move this around. Can you say a little bit about, talk a little bit about how your understanding of the economics of infrastructure influences the choice between emphasizing net neutrality and moving to common carriage of bits and public investment on the model of municipal broadband? So different models of infrastructures in different systems. So you focused on internet, on net neutrality. Say a little bit more about that, and then.
Sure. So, one good critique of this book, which I've kind of critiqued myself on this in this regard, is that I end up focusing on commons management non-discrimination rules, both with respect to competitors and with respect to users or customers, as a way to alleviate some of the pressures and deal with some of the demand-side concerns. But of course, if you have a non-discrimination rule, you could end up with average cost pricing, or frankly, if you don't have competition, you could end up with monopoly pricing, right? So the whole point is that if you price it at monopoly pricing, you might get a whole lot of deadweight loss and we might be worse off, right? So in other words, a good critique is, does commons management or non-discrimination rules go far enough, right? You don't address the supply side. What I do in the book is I address the demand side. This is why we value things. This is where the value comes from. Let's think about how we get value, what we want. And in many cases, I think non-discrimination rules help us preserve and get what we want. But often it might not go far enough, right? We might need units. So from the supply side, right, we might think about who's going to supply, how are we going to recover our costs, are there impediments to entry, right? And then you start asking questions along the lines of, well, you know, is public provisioning or public subsidy of tax incentives for new build-out versus public investment in R&D that makes entry cheaper versus government actually entering, and then which government? All of which I think should be on the table. I mean, I think all of those things are important. I think the ideas in the book, especially the ideas about the value, suggest that there is a role for government to play in making sure or ensuring that supply happens. But I think, in a lot of markets, there is adequate incentives to supply. We can rely on private suppliers. And then the question is, if there's pockets where we're not seeing it, municipal entry makes lots of sense. And I think the case, when the municipal government's trying to make the case for making these kinds of investments, the theory helps. I think the sort of the analysis of value helps the municipality explain why investing in provisioning to help their citizens makes sense, because they're supplying not only the private goods, but they're supplying the public and the social goods. So I think it supports those, and some of the chapters get into that question of supply. But I've largely pushed the supply side of the analysis to the side because there's, frankly, thousands and thousands of books and journal articles that talk about how best to supply things. But there's very little analysis on the demand side. So that's kind of where the book is.
Thank you for this very nice presentation. There is something that I'd like you to elaborate on a little bit. The standard economic theory of public goods will mainly apply to markets. So when you want to forbid, to prevent, is to have individual incentives to provide the public good, and you have a cost structure that ends up with only one provider being able to efficiently supply the market. And you want to avoid to have that big incumbent in the market selling at a very high price to consumers this good.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what economic theory tells you, and in that situation, the government should come and regulate the market and set the price so that you have efficiency. I don't quite see how that problem concerns the internet, as you have many, many, many public good providers, as you said, who are willing to supply the public good at actually no cost. So you don't have the same problem with internet-based public goods as you have with traditional infrastructure, which is not properly regulated by markets. So in that case, I would say mainstream economic theory would tell you, if you have all those suppliers, and we still don't understand what motivates them, and that's an important point, how can we promote this? But in my opinion, economic theory would tell you, you shouldn't regulate those kind of places. You should let people free, provide the infrastructure, and let them supply when they want to supply and share. So to me, there are two different questions here, and this has nothing to do with market analysis. So I would like you to elaborate a little bit more on how you see economic theory distorting the debate of public goods over the internet.
Okay.
I don't know if that was
so look, clear. Here's what I want to... So I've got a couple of ideas, and maybe this will help. There are public goods at each layer. There are infrastructural public... Infrastructural goods are just a special subset of public goods that are not only public goods in the sense that they're non-rivalrously consumed, or at least over some range of demand, but also because they're general-purpose inputs into a wide variety of different outputs, right? So there are infrastructural goods at each layer. There are there are a broader set of public goods, right, at multiple layers. So what I'm talking about in the net neutrality debate is the interface between the physical infrastructure and actually sort of the implementation of a commons, let's say through TCP/IP at the logical layer, right? And thinking about the interface between the infrastructural layers and the content application and social layer. So regulating here is to help facilitate or keep an environment in which producers of public and social goods at the social content and applications layer thrive, right? So it's not... you started out with sort of a theory of... Well, it sounded like you were giving a theory of sort of a natural monopoly idea where we only have one provider. And the idea is not that at the content layer or the applications layer, or definitely not at the social layer, we're not thinking of natural monopolists supplying being the relevant public goods theory, right? Social goods, social capital, for example, right, is produced by many distributed people. The idea that you'd have one producer of social capital itself is sort of almost an oxymoron. Doesn't really fit. The classic econ theory about the role of government regulating a natural monopolist doesn't conflict at all with anything that I said or at the book. Right? If it's true that at the physical infrastructural layer we've got a natural monopoly, which I believe someone in the room might be writing a book sort of getting into this quite a bit more, right? And so if we believe that this is a natural monopoly, then yes, we don't want one monopolist charging monopoly prices and directing the future of all higher-level activities, because they will be biased in the way that they do it to not only will they charge monopoly prices, right? But they're going to think in terms of where are the output markets, what are the applications, content, and social things that give us that generate the most appropriate returns for us. So the harms of a monopolist at the lowest layer are not just monopoly pricing, which should justify regulation to bring the price down to average cost pricing, right? But rather are also concerns about this specialization or optimization over time, right? So the case for government regulation, if we have a natural monopolist, I haven't contested that. That's largely a supply-side question about sort of whether the supplier is charging monopoly rents or not, or charging monopoly prices or not.
Just from what you just said, that's what I was really asking about before. I would have thought, and you didn't emphasize it in the talk, but you do have a section on the book on the role of optionality in uncertain markets and the fact that private providers will have an incentive to maximize under uncertainty.
Yes.
To maximize optionality under uncertainty.
Yep.
As a component of your argument that would support structural separation and common carriage, precisely because then the private infrastructure provider sees the gains of the optionality as long-term returns on the infrastructure as opposed to the integrated. So that's what I thought from your framework would apply to that question, and I would urge you to think about that because that's actually cutting off that integration and creating a general purpose infrastructure with maximal returns to diverse uses would convert the incentives, at least according to the uncertainty option value framework that you lay out for common carriage. That's at least how I interpreted it.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say in general. It depends on the particular infrastructure that we're talking about, right? So so what Professor Brinkley is referring to, I think, is that in Chapter 5, I talk about commons management is a strategy that often makes perfect sense from a business case perspective. In other words, there's a private strategy to manage your infrastructure in a non-discriminatory way when you don't know what the future sources of market value will be. So where there's uncertainty about which of these output markets over here will actually generate private returns for me, right? I have an incentive, and there's a big literature on this, right? Option theory suggests that I should maintain it generically until I'll let the market sort it out, let people experiment. The market will select the best application later, right? And that's right. And so where, in fact, the private strategy coincides with the social strategy, right, the way you'd analyze the role for government intervention might be different. In the internet context, so I sort of acknowledge this in the internet chapter, I believe that from a private strategy perspective or a private option value perspective, it still is in the infrastructure owner's, the network owner's best interest not to prioritize, to maintain a generic infrastructure, because they don't know where the future sources of market value are going to come from, but they think they know, right? They're tempted by certain video. I mean, they're tempted by certain applications they think are going to be the applications that lead to the most returns, right? And so to the extent that there's a risk that the private strategy and the public strategy don't actually coincide very well, I think the case for a non-discrimination rule still makes sense. I'll keep thinking about it. I think that's, I've thought about, so a whole part of the book that got excised once it got, I don't know if any of you have seen it, it's a 450-page book, but the part that I planned to do that was in my book proposal was a comparative analysis of different provisioning mechanisms and how that would sort of follow off, you know, build off of this. It just ended up being too much to get into this far. So in the future, that's certainly something I think is sort of teed up by this book. That is something that would be worth studying.
Hi. I just have a question about, I guess, some of the different types of infrastructure. I mean, you started speaking broadly about infrastructure and trying to make sort of broadly applicable generalizations and then kind of honed in on digital communications infrastructure to speak to this internet question. Maybe that's what you've talked to us mostly about because of the audience assembled. But I guess I wonder, I mean, you said one word about why the internet might have such an array of users and how that would sort of make it even more, that this model would be more applicable. But then I wonder, like, that doesn't seem to fully explain why this would be different from a transportation infrastructure or something of that nature, where we not only have, or we don't have price discrimination, but we have actual, like, you know, physical constraints and regulation discrimination. And I guess I just, then my question to you is, like, are the same principles applicable or similar ones? And, like, is this fully discriminated from that context?
That's a good, I mean, it's a great question. I mean, so yes, much of the latter part of the book applies the ideas to other areas. I mean, even things like ecosystems in the environmental chapter, ideas are infrastructure and sort of explain the intellectual property system to some degree by understanding about certain infrastructural resources that are within that, that are regulated in that system. You know, telecom and roads, certainly, I think the electricity grid, I mean, I think there's a lot of other infrastructure for which that are certainly mixed infrastructure in the sense that they're shareable inputs, they're shared means to many ends, and those ends include user production of private goods that are sort of, we demand in private market settings really well, but also many public goods and social goods. And we tend to sort of truncate the public and social goods because they're hard. And they're hard to sort of measure, hard to understand. I think the net neutrality context, every single thing you do online involves the exchange of public goods. Everything. You're always exchanging information. Right? It's always data. It's always information exchange among people. It's always social, and it's always involving information. So it's a rather easy, I think, to persuade people that when we're talking about the internet, we're always talking about public and social goods, right? And so it's a somewhat easier case for people to grab onto and say, oh, I see it. Yeah, there's just information of all different kinds being exchanged all the time among people in different kinds of social relationships, building trust, building social capital, allowing us to do even more. And so it's easy to kind of grab on. But that's true of roads. Like, think about how you've got two distant communities. What happens when you build the first road, a highway that connects them, right? Yes, as Carol Rose wrote about this in sort of like one of the best law review articles of all time. If you haven't read it, you should. You know, it not only enables commerce, and increasing use of the roads to engage in commerce is great, makes everyone better off. The size of a market not goes from local to regional, right? But it also lets people exchange ideas, customs, understand how other people live, right? All kinds of cultural and social goods, public and social goods, get exchanged just by virtue of the connection made. Now, of course, there might be diminishing returns as you add more and more transport connections, right? So that doesn't always apply to all transportation infrastructure, right? But where you're connecting up people or different systems that are not otherwise connected, that you get the same kind of dynamics going. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. Then I guess I just wonder, like, why did you take on this, like, case where... Sorry. It seems like the net neutrality proposal, we're already, like, functioning largely in that way. And, of course, there's a threat to it, but it seems like in so many other contexts, we're so far from the ideal of, neutrality in the use of the infrastructure.
Yeah. The net neutrality debate's a nice debate to take on because there's currently a regulatory debate that's exactly on point about this particular kind of issue. There are a bunch of other applications sort of mentioned and discussed, and you're right that there are other. But I don't know. I don't know. Maybe we're seeing things differently. So when I look at the road system, I think in general, roads are managed on a non-discriminatory basis. There are exceptional things like hot lanes where you can pay for priority, but you got to remember, 90%+ of the roads in this country are government-owned, right, and are managed as commons. Now, it's true that there are exceptions. In highly congested areas, there are HOV lanes where everyone has access right? It's about reducing congestion. It's a way of rationing to reduce congestion in a non-discriminatory way. Hot lanes, which is a way that you can pay for priority, is pretty rare. It's not the norm. So whenever you give a talk about this, people always say, but what about hot lanes? And it's true, but they're very rare. That doesn't describe the road infrastructure that we all experience typically. Now, do you have a different vision? Well, maybe I should let other people go, but we'll talk later, because it seems like you have a different vision of roads as discriminatory.
I wonder how you would manage disasters in this type of framework.
That's a good question. So disasters meaning that in the case of an emergency, there's a case for priority? Or do you mean something else? I'm not sure. Because I think that's right. I think in the case of a disaster...
A disaster supposedly always becomes a priority, but it doesn't always happen that way, right? But if you look at the larger framework and the network neutrality that you're advocating, how would you handle it?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good... my answer is... I feel like my answer is too simple, because my simple answer is just in the case of emergency or disaster, I think you make exceptions, and those exceptions can be crafted as special exceptions to the general rule to the rule of non-discrimination. And in fact, it's not clear to me that that's all that controversial that we would make an exception, whether it's for how we manage access in the roads and we give the siren blaring to we step aside for the emergency vehicles, and I think the same basic principle applies with respect to the internet. And I think you could make the case that, in the case of a true demonstrated emergency, right? Okay, I think, but that's very different than claims of a perceived security threat leads to people behaving in a non-transparent way and not actually having to show that there was a security threat and just claiming reasonableness as an exception. So I think there's some variation there.
Thank you for the presentation. I wanted to make a comment on the layers between what you call applications, and then the content, in the sense of the case that you have presented on with YouTube would be YouTube as the application, the infrastructure provider would be Google. So I have developed an analysis, a statistical analysis about how the typology of infrastructure provision of applications might shape, actually, which is the content.
Might shape?
The content produced. So I have analyzed the relationship between the type of infrastructure provision of application and the type of use that the user does.
Okay, so are you saying the infrastructural application, that there are certain applications like YouTube as a sharing platform or Wikipedia or something that...
Yeah, in the sense of there are different type of infrastructure providers of applications. There are some non-profit, which like the Wikimedia Foundation, which provide the infrastructure for Wikipedia, that they are based on free software and free license. And in contrast, there are corporate services like Google for YouTube or Yahoo for Flickr, in which cases the community of users cannot have a much limited possibility to intervene in the governance of the infrastructure, or the infrastructure is based on proprietary software and proprietary and restricted license. So basically, what I am trying to say is that according to my analysis, depending on the type of infrastructure provision, the type of infrastructure provider, and the type of software and license be used in that govern the infrastructure, you have a different type of community. So basically, the communities and the user use of the infrastructure, they are not neutral to the typology of infrastructure. So with an infrastructure which is based on conditions that provide more control of the user, in the sense of it's based on free software and based on a free license, and the users can control in some way what the infrastructure provider does and how does govern and manage the infrastructure. In those cases, you have a much more collaborative communities. So more infrastructure which is provided in a conditions that give the user much more control, the users tend to inject in much more collaborative production than not if the infrastructure is based in a more untransparent or more restricted type of format.
That's great. So send me the paper. I mean, that's not, send me the work, because that sounds. It kind of connects with the points made earlier about addressing different provisioning mechanisms, and certainly community. So the other thing, another pet peeve I have is sort of separating into market versus government, right? So there's nothing. There's no. Anyone who talks in binary terms, and I've done so in this talk, so I apologize. In binary terms, government versus market or public versus private are starting from a flawed position anyway in terms of the provisioning question, because community provisioning, and there's plenty of other nuanced ways of providing infrastructure. And so it's an interesting. So the idea that different modes of provisioning, and the more you involve the community itself in the provisioning decisions, affects the behavior of the users, is not surprising. It seems like that coincides with what my expectations would be. I'm looking forward to sort of seeing how, you know, it plays out in your study.
Last question. So, if there's Susan, you haven't asked it,
Well, I have a very quick question. So you showed us this social value function at some point, and you explained that like the social value function was higher on average than the private value function, but that we don't actually know the shape of that value function. Who's producing the highest value for the public, right? And you said that like there are important implications from knowing the exact like shape of that function, and I don't understand why that follows. As soon as you have like your social function that's higher on average than your private function, your net neutrality rule follows, given that you shouldn't let anybody put private contracts on those kind of markets. You shouldn't let a market emerge, actually.
Right.
So you shouldn't let people like take property rights on those kind of things, and let the market, the place, totally free for people to exchange. So what is it important? Yeah. I didn't understand why is it important to know the precise.
Yeah, it's, oh, no, don't get me wrong. It's the fact that we don't know it that matters, not the fact that, it's not my task for all of you now is not to go out and try to figure out what social demand curves look like, right? Because as my claim is, we don't know what they look like, and we shouldn't assume that they have the same shape. Why does it matter? Well, it matters because if you have a priority regime, right, you're going to prioritize based on the most appropriate bell based on private value, which means you might prioritize 1, 2, and 3. And you might say, well, it doesn't really matter because we're getting this spillovers. Yeah, we're missing some others, but you know, it's symmetric or we might not care as much. Right? Another reason why is one standard solution to that we're not going to get enough public goods. Suppose we've got this picture, right? Suppose, so some economist says, no, it's just the red line. And then, you know, Susan convinces us, no, use type 6 gradients, all this social value. We want people to be able to engage in this activity. Who knows what the answer is? What's the economic professor going to say we ought to do now? We know what it is. Thanks, Susan, you pointed it out for us. It's U6. We know what it is. Government should direct subsidies there. There's a direct way for dealing with this problem, and then we can let the market take care of the rest. The problem is, if it's variable, we don't know, and we can't trust just sort of our instinct to say, oh, we found one social use. Rely on the government to direct subsidies. It doesn't work when there's lots of them and it's variable. Right? So I want to make sure this comes across clear, because this, I think, is one of, at least from my own perspective, I'm one of the most proud of this point, of this getting across. Because the idea that the social demand curve is, one, that there is such a thing, that they're generating these spillovers, and two, that we don't know what it looks like, and it might just be unknowable, right? That's what supports the idea of social option theory, or the idea that actually that's why we want to maintain it generically. Even if we know the market value, and with a lot of certainty where the future market value is going to come from. Video on demand, that's where all the money is going to be, right? That doesn't help. And in fact, it makes it worse, because it means that there's more incentives on the private side to prioritize. Right? To the extent we don't know where the social value is coming from, there's a case for maintaining it generically.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.